draw near, and they will be heard. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, Council. I'm Nancy Moritz. I'm sitting in Topeka this morning via Zoom, and I'm joined by two of my excellent colleagues, Judge Allison Ide, who's in Denver, and Senior Judge Bobby Baldock, who's out in Roswell, New Mexico today. And we were kind of used to this Zoom thing now, and you're not, I suppose, or maybe you are, but at least not Zoom arguments. But it usually goes pretty smoothly, and we'll hope for that today. We have on the docket four cases, but one case, the third case, is being submitted on the briefs today. So we'll have three arguments, and our plan right now is to just go straight through. But that could change, and we'll let you know if we're going to take a break. With that, I'll call the first case, number 219538, Smith versus FRS. Mr. Factor?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jordan Factor. I represent Frank Smith and Mark Kielbasa. Article 2 vests the entire executive power of the government in the President of the United States and charges him with faithfully executing the law. Since 1789, it has been commonly understood and accepted that essential to the faithful execution of the law is the power of removal. The power to remove those executive officers who assist the president in carrying out his responsibilities. Almost a century ago in Myers, the Supreme Court held that the president's power of removal is unrestricted. That must be the case. Otherwise, Congress could hinder the president in his ability to execute the law by saddling him with incompetent or disloyal subordinates. Another consequence of removal restrictions is that it insulates the president from public accountability, allowing him to distance himself from the unpopular decisions of subordinates.
Counsel, now, admittedly, counsel, I hate to jump in right now when you're in full swing of your argument, but you also raise a question of jurisdiction, and it's our obligation always to first determine, do we or don't we have jurisdiction? And we are a court of limited jurisdiction. Now, why, if we look at the statute in regards to the appropriate federal banking agency seems to be where you're tying your jurisdictional question too. And we also operate on the theory that if Congress wants us to have jurisdiction, they very well know how to say where the jurisdiction lies in regards to this. But why doesn't the language of the appropriate federal banking agency kind of whitewash or cover that whole area so that in the banking industry that the appropriate bank, whoever is trying to stop you from working with them, would have jurisdiction to do that under the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I believe it is undisputed that this court has jurisdiction. There's no question that this court has jurisdiction. The issue is whether the Board of Governors.
Wait a minute, counsel. You're now conceding that we have jurisdiction in this. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, sir. This court has jurisdiction.
Appellate jurisdiction. You're referring to appellate jurisdiction, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so in terms of whether this court needs to reach the jurisdictional issue before the constitutional issue, it does not, because this court has jurisdiction. And
counsel, in my perspective of what we've done, you caused the court to waste a whole lot of man hours, it looks to me like, in making sure that the issue of jurisdiction. So you've conceded that. I apologize for interrupting. Proceed with your other argument then.
So, Your Honor, returning to the constitutional argument.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry. Before you return, can you please help us understand where you raised this argument you're making now below?
We did not.
So you concede you did not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so please help me understand why you can make it before us now.
Because there is no regulatory exhaustion requirement, and this court ought not to choose to apply an exhaustion requirement. The Board of Governors does not cite a single statute or regulation that required appellants to raise this issue before the ALJ. The only regulation that the Board of Governors cites is 12 CFR 263.39A pertaining to exceptions to the ALJ's recommended decision. And 263.39C says expressly that exceptions are limited to those matters contained within the ALJ's decision. And undisputedly, the ALJ's decision did not raise this issue. So there simply was no regulatory exhaustion requirement here. However,
well, but the issue is whether that moving back to the regulation, the regulation essentially says you've got to exhaust with the ALJ before you can raise an exception to the board. So why didn't you have to exhaust with the ALJ in the first instance? That's really the question, I think.
Because the
why isn't this exactly what regulatory exhaustion is all about?
Because the ALJ is limited to considering those matters contained within 5 USC 563, and that does not include this kind of structural.
Well, that section, if I'm recalling correctly, is your APA statute that basically says, you know, procedurally what ALJ can do at a formal hearing. I don't see where anything about that indicates what issues you can raise before this ALJ. Is there anything else you can point to that would have barred you from raising this issue to the ALJ?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing that bars us from raising this issue.
But right. And all this regulation requires is an opportunity to raise the objection. So if there wasn't anything that barred you from raising it, I don't understand why the exhaustion wouldn't apply.
Well, Your Honor, in order for regulatory exhaustion to apply, the party is required to raise this issue. And there's no requirement. In terms of whether the court should determine that the party nevertheless should have raised the issue in the absence of an express requirement, this court should look to the Supreme Court's recent decision in Carr v. Saul, where the court held that the individual was not required to raise an appointments clause challenge before the ALJ in that case. Because of two reasons. Number one, administrative agencies are particularly ill-suited to consider the kinds of structural constitutional issues that are at issue here. And second, because the ALJ was powerless to do anything about it, and therefore raising the issue would be futile. And this court and the Supreme Court has a well-recognized futility exception to exhaustion.
Why here can you explain why the agency was powerless to do anything about it? Sure, the board suggests that there was definitely something that could have been done, that the board could have substituted itself as one of its members, which is provided for by their regulations, as the hearing officer. Why would that not have resolved that issue?
So, first of all, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has said numerous times that exercising various bureaucratic machinations and minutiae is no substitute for the at-will removal power of the president. Secondly, what the board suggests is simply not practical. Here, Congress in FIREA directed the board and five other agencies to create a pool of administrative judges to adjudicate these issues. And though the board, comprised of seven members, each of whom is removable only for cause, theoretically could have taken up this action, it can't take up every single enforcement proceeding, every one of which would be plagued by the very same.
That's not really, that wouldn't have been your issue, however. The issue would have been whether they could have somehow made a substitution in this case. You wouldn't be tasked with remedying the issue for any other case, would you?
No, but respectfully, Your Honor, the court has said, Supreme Court has said repeatedly that you don't look at a counterfactual scenario or a universe or some parallel universe where this proceeding could have been conducted constitutionally. You look at the circumstance before you and whether it was in fact conducted constitutionally.
Well, that's if we get to the merits, but right now we're talking about exhaustion. So in any event, continue, I'm sorry.
So I'm a little confused. We've talked about exhaustion and jurisdiction, but I thought the jurisdictional question went to whether or not the board had any jurisdiction in this matter. And we've got jurisdiction, but what are you doing, Cal? Are you not conceding that the board did have jurisdiction? Where are you in regards to that argument?
Right, the board did not have jurisdiction here. The FDIC and the FDIC alone had jurisdiction because the conduct at issue took place at an FDIC-regulated bank, which is the appropriate bank agency for the depository institution. Section 1818E refers to depository institutions solely in terms of where the conduct transpired, where the financial harm occurred. And so, no, the board did not have jurisdiction here. Constitutionally, the board may not have had jurisdiction either. The Supreme Court.
Well, I've
taken enough of your time in regards. I'll just have to work my way through where you are now into that jurisdictional question. I don't want to take up any more of your time in regards to your argument that you started out with.
Thank you, Your Honor. And what I was about to say about constitutional jurisdiction is the Supreme Court in recent decisions, especially Seal of Law, seriously circumscribed the opinion in Humphrey's Executor and in Morrison v. Olson. And it's not clear in light of Seal of Law whether Humphrey's Executor even remains good law. And if it's not, that's a further absence of constitutionality and would not be remedied by the board simply taking this matter into its own hands, which it did not. But again, the issue is whether the structure allows the president to exercise meaningful supervision and control over the ALJ, and where the president would have to traverse the board, would have to get unanimous consent amongst all four agencies comprising the OFIA, would have to persuade the Merit Systems Protection Board to take adverse action, which it's only permitted to do following notice and a hearing. That's a labyrinthine structure that does not survive recent Supreme Court precedent. And I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Chadwick.
Good morning. May it please the court. Joshua Chadwick for the Federal Reserve Board. I'd like to begin this morning with the forfeiture argument. As I think the panel has recognized, it has the ability to dispense with the substantive constitutional issue. And the court need look no further on this issue than its decision in Energy West Mining, where it needed less than a page to dispense with a very similar forfeiture issue in an appointments clause case. And the court held that if relief were possible before the agency, then the issue must have been raised before the agency in the first instant. Petitioner's counsel has conceded that nothing barred them from raising the issue and that they did not do so. And the board assuredly could have afforded relief here. Executive branch agencies.
Can I step back a second? I understand what he just Mr. Factor just said in argument, but I read their brief to be suggesting that there really was no way to raise this because the ALJ didn't have the authority to act on it, even if it had been raised.
Well, first off, Your Honor, the ALJ certainly would have had the power to address a motion raised on this issue, but certainly the board in
How would that have been? How would that ALJ have addressed that motion? How would the motion have been raised, first of all? Would it be a motion to disqualify the ALJ or?
Well, certainly that's an option, Your Honor, and the APA specifically provides for that at 556B. It says that a party can raise the issue of a disqualified official and the agency shall address it. So there's a mandatory requirement that that an adjudicator consider disqualification. And of course, the board's rules provide for motions practice. They provide for interlocutory appeal. And they, of course, provide for review with a recommended decision. And any issues that are either in that decision or that are omitted from the decision, which is something that the board's rules also say, can be raised. So there's no question that even if you're to accept the argument that the ALJ couldn't have done anything about it, and I don't accept that argument because I think the ALJ could have withdrawn himself from the case and the board would have had to have addressed that issue. But in any event,
couldn't have ruled on a motion to dismiss, apparently, but could they have filed the motion to dismiss nevertheless and then had it go straight to the board as they did on the jurisdictional issue? Would that be
certainly? Certainly, Your Honor. In fact, that's a good point. The petitioners did take advantage of the board's motions practice for the ALJ and the interlocutory appeal procedure to raise their jurisdictional challenge up to the board. And when the board's opinion addressing that, it noted in a footnote that petitioners or respondents below, but the parties always have a chance to raise whether they're jurisdictional issues or other dispositive issues before the ALJ. And the ALJ could have recommended a decision on that issue that the board would have taken up in the course of its responsibility to always issue a final decision in these cases.
Thank you.
And just to address a couple of other points that Mr. Factor raised, Your Honor, one on futility. The futility bar is quite high. Generally, it's addressed only in cases where there's no statute or regulation requiring issue exhaustion. Of course, as you noted, there is a regulation here that requires it. And even in cases, I think this court's decision in Maloof addresses the futility question quite clearly, shows that it's an extremely high bar. And with respect to Carr, that's a very different circumstance than the circumstance presented here. In that case, once again, the Supreme Court was considering a circumstance in the Social Security Administration where there was no regulatory or statutory exhaustion requirement. So there was no regulatory exhaustion requirement as there is here. Also, those proceedings are not adversarial, they're inquisitorial. And so there's no discovery. Often there's no lawyers, there's no briefing. So the Supreme Court made clear to explain all these facts in showing why in that particular circumstance, it may have been futile. Also, in that case, the claimants for benefits could not reach the Commissioner of Social Security and could not have possibly obtained the relief that they were seeking. That's very different than the circumstance here, where the board certainly could have afforded relief. And the idea that it would be entirely impractical, as Mr. Factor suggested, I think, obviously it's not the board's desire to hear these cases. It has delegated hearing functions to ALJs, but the current docket of board enforcement actions pending for ALJs is only two cases. There's seven members of the board. So, you know, there certainly is a possibility that the board could have addressed it. The hearing on the merits in this case only lasted one day. So, you know, whatever petitioners may say about the practicality of it, the point is they could have raised the issue and the board would have been in a position to at least consider it, address it, provide relief, or decline to provide relief, but at a minimum develop the records that it would be developed for this court. And I'd like to address one other point that petitioners first raised in their reply, and that's the notion that the board couldn't have heard the case, or an individual board member couldn't have heard the case, because the board is itself not an impartial arbiter. Of course, that issue wasn't raised below or in their opening brief, so it's doubly forfeited. But in any event, the board's initiation of enforcement action is required by statute at 1818E4, and in no way disqualifies it from either hearing a case or issuing the final decision, which is, of course, also required by statute. And the APA itself at 5 USC 554D2C expressly precludes the board and its members from the APA's separation of functions requirements. And the Supreme Court has actually addressed similar issues in a number of cases, including Withrow v. Larkin, 421 U.S. 35. That's Justice White's opinion. And then a prior case, FTC v. Cement Institute, 333 U.S. 683. And in those cases, what the Supreme Court said was the mere investigation, initiation of charges in a case does not render an administrative agency incapable of later hearing the case on the merits. That would not be a violation of due process. So essentially what petitioners are raising here in reply is a due process claim about what the board could or couldn't do. But clearly the board could have been an impartial arbiter. Obviously they're principal officers appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and afforded a presumption of good faith. And certainly they could have, or an individual member could have heard this case. And then I'd like to then move to the substance of the constitutional challenge for a moment. And on this issue, I think it's important to remember that the board has plenary control over its appointment use of ALJs. As a result, there's no concern about MSPB jurisdiction and no reason for the court here to reach a constitutional issue that's not even presented, even if it had not been forfeited by not raising the issue below. The ALJ statute regarding the MSPB, 5 USC 7521, is specifically limited to, quote, an agency in which the ALJ is employed. Indisputably here, that's the FDIC. The board does not employ the ALJs. In fact, if you look at Exhibit 2 to the board's brief, the red brief, it makes clear, and that's where the actual appointment is attached. It makes clear that these individuals remain FDIC employees, that the board appointment does not come with any pay or benefits from the board. So I think there's just no doubt about it. I think the petitioner suggested in their brief that the ALJ was not properly appointed. There's simply no basis for that argument. There's no citation. The appointment is attached and available for the court's review. But even if all that were not true, petitioners base their whole argument on free enterprise fund, which cannot bear the weight they place upon it. The Supreme Court made clear in note 10 of that case that it was not reaching ALJs who have far more limited adjudicatory responsibilities and far more limited removal protections than the PCAOB members at issue there. In fact, then Judge Kavanaugh, in his dissent at note 8 in the D.C. Circuit's decision in Free Enterprise, said that nothing in his dissenting opinion would affect ALJs in any way. And one final point on the merits is that even if petitioners were correct, and they're not, that they would not be able to obtain any relief in this court. And that's clear from the Supreme Court's Collins decision. This issue is expressed pretty well in the Ninth Circuit's Decker-Cole decision, that as long as there's a valid appointment, which I think is quite clear here, that the petitioners would not be entitled to any relief without showing some cognizable harm. And they can't do that here. Recall, their view is that the ALJ is predisposed toward the board, so it's impossible to see how placing the ALJ under closer board control would have benefited them in any way. So given the valid appointment, they would not be entitled to any relief, even if they were right. And with that, I'd like to address briefly the jurisdictional question regarding the FDI Act. And I think here the key issue is that the text of 1818E and every indicia of statutory interpretation point to the same result, and that's that the statute unambiguously permits the board to reach the prior conduct of its IAPs at, quote, any insured depository institution or business institution. Petitioners offer generalities about the regulatory division among the three banking regulatory agencies over institutions, but fail to address the fact that the entire focus and subject of 1818 is IAPs, or individuals. In fact, because 1818 is itself an employment-based provision, the, quote, appropriate federal banking agency for the depository institution, at the end of that section, must refer to the employing bank. There is no other option. The phrase could only refer to the employing bank or the bank where the misconduct occurred, but it must be the former, given that some of the regulated conduct need not have occurred at a bank at all. And the Supreme Court has addressed this statutory interpretation question on any number of occasions cited in our brief. But in Kochai's consultancy, they said, quote, a single use of a statutory phrase must have a fixed meaning. And here, 1818E may be complex, but it's not ambiguous. Careful examination of the statute makes clear that the references to the, quote, appropriate federal banking agency in both the introductory and closing clauses to 1818E refer to the regulator of the employing bank, not the regulator of the institution where the misconduct occurred. Certainly, the references in between there do talk about, quote, depository institution or business institution. Obviously, those references do contemplate where the misconduct occurred, but this does nothing to change the meaning of the introductory and closing references, which is where the grant of authority is reflected.
Would Central Bank, which is, I believe, the bank that where they had been employed, were formerly employed, would it qualify as a, even though it was not an insured depository institution, would it qualify as a business institution?
Well,
I don't think you're relying on that, but would it?
Well, actually, Your Honor, it would be an insured depository institution. The question is just whether or not it's a member. So the way the bank.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Right. But right.
So there's an FD. It's insured, but it's not a member of the Federal Reserve System. So
right. It's not a member.
It's a state right. Non-member bank is the term. So it would be regulated primarily by the FDIC, whereas the bank that the individuals moved to, Farmers, is a member of the Federal Reserve System. So it's regulated by the board.
Right.
So there's no reason to reach the business institution question,
right.
But
okay.
But of course, the FDIC does retain concurrent jurisdiction for a period of 6 years, and there's no question about that. But that does nothing to call into question the board's jurisdiction over its own IEPs, the officers and directors of the banks that it supervises. The board certainly, in order to protect those institutions, the shareholders of those institutions, and the deposit insurance fund is entitled to take suspension or removal actions in the appropriate circumstances. And I think in their reply, the petitioners suggest that the board has other power, which is true, to cease and desist power of 1818B, but there's no suggestion that by giving the board cease and desist authority, that Congress somehow sub silentio meant to take away with their authority to suspend or remove their own, the employees of the banks that they regulate. So I think in the final analysis, the board's jurisdiction is clear. No fair reading of the statute or any authority, certainly that petitioners have cited, would call into question, and the petition should be denied as a result.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Factor, you had some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Beginning with the exhaustion argument, Carvey Saul suggests very strongly that structural constitutional issues need not be raised before the agency. The administrative agencies, administrative exhaustion is required because administrative agencies, number one, typically have greater scientific or industry expertise that allows them to rule on issues and develop a record before it comes before the courts. And second, because they have the power to take immediate remedial action. That's simply not the case with structural constitutional challenges. The agencies have no greater expertise when it comes to determining whether a given structure sufficiently allows the president to exercise supervision and control over an inferior officer. And there really is no meaningful ability to remedy a structural challenge. As the court observed in Carr, the ALJ could not cure the defects in his own appointment. The ALJ here could not cure the defects in this structural issue that deprived him of constitutional authority. These are questions that are best reserved for the court. And there's nothing that could have been developed below that could assist the court in reaching that issue. This is not a typical constitutional issue that comes before ALJs, like a due process challenge, where the ALJ can immediately rectify the issue by changing the course of the proceeding. These structural issues are best left for courts, and this court should reach the merits of the issue and determine that the system here, as in SELA law and Free Enterprise Fund, is repugnant to the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate both of your arguments today, as well as your briefing. They've been very helpful. The case will be submitted and counsel are excused.
Thank you.
Thank you.